Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People started disappearing.
The Guzman just fell out of a helicopter.
Uh-oh, what's going on here?
The $6 billion gold scam from the BBC World Service and CBC.
Money is very, very dangerous.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Thursday, the 30th of May. The jury in Donald Trump's criminal trial is considering its verdict. Israel says it's gained military control of the strip of land along the Gaza-Egypt border. And counting is underway in the South African election, the biggest test for the ANC since the end of apartheid. Also in the podcast, evidence that ancient Egyptians may have tried to treat cancer more than 4,000 years ago. And
my boss said, go out, and everybody stopped work and ran out very fast. And oh, my heart almost stressful. Yeah.
A new volcanic eruption in Iceland forces thousands to evacuate. Although it is seen as the least serious of the four criminal cases facing Donald Trump, the hush money trial in New York will go down in US history as the first involving a sitting or former American president. Mr. Trump is accused of 34 counts of falsifying business records to cover up a payment to the porn actress Stormy Daniels in the 2016 election campaign. The outcome, which could have an impact on the presidential election this November, now rests with the jury, which has completed its deliberations for the day. Speaking outside court, Mr. Trump didn't sound very hopeful.
Mother Teresa could not beat these charges. These charges are rigged. The whole thing is rigged. The whole country's a mess between the borders and fake elections, and you have a trial like this where the judge is so conflicted he can't breathe. He's got to do his job, and it's not for me, that I can tell you. It's a disgrace.
Our correspondent, Neda Taufik, has been following developments from outside the court in New York. She told James Menendez the jury had asked to have another look at some of the evidence.
There was a buzzer. There was a note from jurors that they want to see testimony. They want it read back to them. Now, part of that is from a Trump Tower meeting in August of 2015. They want to read both David Pecker's testimony, that's the former publisher of the tabloid The National Enquirer, and Michael Cohen's testimony regarding that meeting. He is, of course, Trump's former fixer. And the reason why that meeting is important is because that's when prosecutors said the whole catch and kill scheme, as they put it, was formulated, where the National Enquirer would buy up stories and kill them, not have them published, in order to help Donald Trump's campaign to get him into the White House. And the prosecutors say that was a key part of the conspiracy that was later covered up. Now, prosecutors will perhaps be happy to see that the jury is taking their job very seriously. They're looking at this because they had described in their closing arguments David Pecker's testimony as devastating and something that can stand on its own apart from Michael Cohen. Jurors also want to see Pecker's testimony regarding a phone conversation with Donald Trump while Pecker was in an investor meeting, and also testimony from Pecker when he decided to finalize buying the life rights of the Playboy model Karen McDougal. So again, testimony, key parts of it from the first witness in this case for the prosecution, David Pecker.
What did the judge tell the jurors before they went out?
He gave them some of the standard instructions that they need to not take any bias against Donald Trump into account. They have to just look at the facts of the case, that they have to reach a unanimous decision. So to listen carefully to each other's opinions and really take that into deep consideration. But then he also spoke about the law at work here. He said they have to find not only that Donald Trump falsified business records himself or with others, but that he tried to conceal another crime. He says those two parts are necessary to convict Donald Trump.
Neda Taufik, outside court in New York. The Israeli army says it now has full operational control of the Philadelphia Corridor, a 14-kilometer strip of land that runs along Gaza's southern border. The military believes that as a result, Hamas can no longer smuggle in weapons through tunnels under the frontier with Egypt. Despite this, a senior Israeli security official says he expects fighting in Gaza to continue until at least the end of the year. For more on the significance of the latest Israeli operation, we heard from our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
It was only a week or two ago that, as part of the offensive in Rafah, the Israeli army has launched, they took over the actual border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. And now they've taken over this zone which basically runs along the border. Part of the reason, I think, is to do with trying to degrade the ability of Hamas to keep its supply of weapons going. I mean, as you were saying, the Israeli military says that they found around 20 tunnels. Now, those tunnels are kind of a known secret, if one can call it that. I mean, Israel has said for a long time that that's one of the routes that Hamas has been able to get weapons into Gaza from. Now, Egypt, on the other side of the border, has already denied this since the statement was made by the Israeli military spokesman. I mean, those tunnels, such as they are, have been used certainly to bring food and other sorts of supplies into Gaza from outside, as has happened in other parts of the enclave. And Egypt itself has often done things to block those tunnels. So this is quite a sore point between Israel and Egypt. I think this will develop. Relations between Israel and Egypt have been really getting pretty poor as the offensive has continued and as it's come right to the border. So that's one element. And another interesting thing, I think, that the military spokesman was saying is that Israel is claiming that Hamas had put some of its rocket launches right almost on the border with Egypt, like 10 metres away, thinking that Israel would not target them because there'd be the danger of overshooting into Egypt, which of course would be another whole headache. And we did have reports just two or three days ago of rockets being fired, I think 8, into the centre of Israel, the first time for several months. And that's where I think that they were fired from. So yes, this is certainly being presented by Israel as quite a big achievement and as another kind of justification for its big military operation in Rafah.
Our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher. Counting is underway in the South African election in the biggest test for the African National Congress since the end of apartheid. The party could lose its majority in parliament for the first time since Nelson Mandela became president in 1994. Support has waned against a backdrop of corruption, rising crime and power shortages. This voter in Pretoria, 34-year-old Manyani Mkosi, said frustration had compelled him to cast his ballot for the first time.
I was like, I cannot really sit and watch what's been happening in our country in terms of the service delivery and everything, because roads and infrastructure, everything is a mess in South Africa at the moment. So I was like, okay, what can I do to make a difference?
I got an update on how voting had gone from our Africa correspondent Barbara Platt-Usher at a counting centre.
There were some hiccups. A number of polling stations opened late because of technical difficulties or because ballots took a while to be delivered, but not a huge number, around 7% of them. So I think mostly it went smoothly. Quite a lot of people came out. What we've heard from the Election Commission is that it looks as if the turnout was higher than it was in the last election in 2019, which is quite something because the numbers had been declining. And there was a late surge as well as we were leaving a polling station and driving through the city, we could see lines like down the streets in a number of places.
Yeah, those lines meant they had to keep some of the polling stations open a little later. Does the fact that there was or appears to have been a high turnout, does that give us any indication of which way the vote might have gone in terms of the ANC's fortunes?
Well, a sort of rule of thumb that the analysts were using was if it's a higher turnout, it's probably less good for the governing ANC party because it might give more votes to the rival parties. But that's not scientific in any way. We're really going to have to see. I can tell you from the voters that I spoke to, broadly speaking, the older ones did tend to be more loyal to the ANC because of its liberation legacy, and also because they were wary that new parties would do a worse job than the ANC has in terms of the economy and corruption scandals and so on. Younger voters, some of whom didn't experience apartheid, were much more critical. And I spoke to a number of them who were clearly going to vote for other parties. And jobs for them was a really big thing because more than 40% of the youth are unemployed. There was certainly a sense that people were looking for something different, some looking for the ANC to fix things and some saying that the ANC just simply needed to be replaced.
And if the ANC doesn't get a majority, as some expect, what should we look out for? Which are the other parties that they might have to do a deal with?
It very much depends on numbers. If the ANC comes close to 50% of the vote, then it could strike an easier deal with smaller parties. If it falls quite a bit below 50%, then it would have to rely on the larger parties, its rivals. So that could force policy trade-offs, and there aren't really easy options. On the right, you have the largest opposition party, the pro-business Democratic Alliance, but it really struggles to shake off its image as a party for the white minority, so that's kind of like an unlikely coalition. You have the economic freedom fighters, which these radical solutions for the economy, nationalizing mines and banks and expropriating land from white farmers and so on, also not an easy coalition partner. So it would be uncharted territory if the ANC lost quite a lot of percentage of the vote and could potentially lead to some instability in governing. Although having said that, perhaps a coalition would make South Africans feel they can better hold their leaders accountable. Certainly that's the sense one got at the voting booths today than if a single party dominates.
And when will we get a good idea of how the voting has actually gone?
Well, the counting has already started. We'll possibly get a sense of early results by sometime on Friday and then the full results sometime at the weekend.
Barbara Plett-Usher in South Africa. The ancient Egyptians may have had a greater medical understanding than one might think. Researchers in Europe say that marks and cuts on a more than 4,000-year-old skull suggest they were trying to treat cancer. Edgard Camaros led the research, which has been published in the journal Frontiers in Medicine. He spoke to Tim Franks.
What we saw is not just the lesion of a cancer, of a neoplastic pathology, but it's also the evidence that more than 4,000 years ago, during the period that we know the ancient Egyptians, they performed a surgical intervention. And this is actually quite a milestone in the history of medicine, because it's telling us that these people had some kind of interest in trying to understand and maybe, who knows, trying to treat cancer.
And you think it was surgery? You think it was treatment? You don't think this was an autopsy?
Well, we know for sure it was an oncological surgery. However, the cut marks, we cannot scientifically say they were made with the patient alive or with the individual already dead. And that's why we call them perimortem cut marks. However, that's very interesting in both of these scenarios, because if the individual was alive, then that's probably a surgical intervention, maybe searching for some kind of treatment. However, if the individual was already dead, that might be related with some kind of medical autopsy, some kind of exploratory intervention. However, in both of the cases, it is certainly a surgical intervention in relation to that tumour.
And how did you know that there was a tumour there? What makes you certain that it was cancer?
We've performed some micro-CT TAC scans. We did also some microscopic observations. And the features that we found on those lesions, the bone pathologies, are very, very characteristics of what we nowadays call cancer or neoplastic diseases. And that's why our diagnosis is related with cancer.
We do tend to think of cancers as being a more recent type of disease. So is that important, do you think?
That's important. And it's true that people tend to think that cancer is a modern disease. However, we obviously know that cancer, it's related to life. It's related to multicellular life. So actually, cancer has been with life since the very beginning of it. But it's true that the incidence of cancer is very, very high nowadays. However, the more we look into our past, the more we find that cancer was really a prevalent disease.
The Egyptians, I mean, I think we knew that they were quite advanced when it came to medicine, but this presumably would be a big leap forward in that.
It is a leap forward, but actually it's interesting to think that there's a context for this surgical intervention, and that's the very advanced and sophisticated ancient Egyptian medicine. We've got, for example, the papyrus, which is a different kind of source rather than bones to try and understand this kind of medicine. And those papyrus, for example, the Edwin Smith papyrus, which dates about 3,600 years ago, They already describe 48 cases of different conditions, but the very interesting case is number 45, which it seems is describing a breast cancer. And the fascinating thing is that whenever they try and say, what could have been the treatment for that? They say, there's no cure. There's no treatment available for that. And this is interesting because although this amazing medicine, they really had this frontier in their medical knowledge when it comes to what we nowadays call cancer. But they did identify tumours, etc.
Professor Edgard Camaros from the University of Santiago de Compostela in Spain. Iceland is once again witnessing the raw power of nature as a volcano erupts some 50 kilometres southwest of the capital Reykjavik. A wall of molten rock is shooting high into the air along a 3-kilometre crack in the Earth's surface, in what the authorities say is the biggest eruption there of recent times. Stephanie Zachrisson reports.
Helicopter footage shows plumes of grey smoke billowing into the air and a long crack from which glowing red lava spews. The authorities had warned of the risk of renewed volcanic activity in the area just south of the capital, Reykjavik, as studies had showed that magma had accumulated underground. Vicky Pedersen heads the Nordic Volcanological Centre at the University of Iceland. She says the next 24 hours will determine how this eruption progresses.
Right now it's a continuous curtain of fire. As it develops with time, it will focus into certain points and eventually often only one or two craters will be active on the long run, but we can't say that by now. We're only observing the initial phase.
It's the fifth volcanic eruption in the area in 6 months, and although it's in an uninhabited part of Iceland, it's northeast of the fishing town of Grindavik, where residents have once again had to evacuate. Petra Thipnet works at a fish processing plant in the town and spoke to journalists as she and her colleagues left.
My boss said, go out, and everybody stop work and run out from the work and go to the car. And I don't have a shoes and I come with my clothes and everyone out very fast. And my heart almost
stressful.
Yeah.
The nearby Blue Lagoon, a popular tourist spot, was also closed to visitors. There are more than 30 active volcano systems in Iceland. The cinematographer Benjamin Hardman, who moved to the island to capture its fascinating natural life, has been documenting volcanic activity for several years. He was filming just a few hundred metres from the eruption.
This is a strange time on the Reykjanes Peninsula. After 800 years, the volcanic system in the area, or actually several of them, have woken up. The general feeling of excitement has kind of shifted as the eruptions move closer to the town of Grindavik and right on the north side of the town, causing widespread evacuation of that town and people to relocate themselves permanently.
It has also reached some of the defensive walls built around Grindavik and nearby US Navy communication towers.
That was Stephanie Zachrisson. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
We've seen it in space, we're seeing it in the deep ocean. Tourists have gone past the, I'm going to see the pyramids, I'm going to see the wonders of the world. They're now looking at the thrills of the world.
As another billionaire plans to take a new submersible to the wreck of the Titanic, what drives the business of underwater tourism? More than 2 years into Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, much of the economy is struggling, not least the hospitality sector. One notable casualty is the Hotel Ukraina in Kyiv. The Soviet-era block, which has more than 350 rooms, is now being auctioned off by the state, with the proceeds going to the war effort, as Isabella Jewell explains.
Since 1961, Hotel Ukraina has borne witness to key moments of Ukrainian history. Not only did it weather the transition from the Soviet era to the country's independence in the 90s, it also overlooks Independence Square, the site of the Bloody Maidan Revolution in 2014, which led to the ousting of pro-Russian president Viktor Yanukovych. More recently, of course, it has sheltered guests, including visiting politicians, from Russia's full-scale invasion. On its website, the four-star hotel boasts a fully equipped bomb bunker and air alert system, as well as a panoramic view from the higher floors on quieter nights. But the time has come for yet another transition. Having been under state ownership for more than 30 years, the government has decided to part with Kyiv's most famous hotel. Despite its impressive appearance, the establishment's profits have tumbled. It's now in more than $1 million of debt. The tourists just aren't coming, understandably put off by Russia's war. The neo-Gothic building and all of its memorabilia will be auctioned off, and the proceeds funneled into Ukraine's war chest. The starting price, more than $30 million. Since the beginning of the war, rumours have swirled about the fate of the hotel. Its location next to the president's office makes it a strategic target. But it has managed to stay in Ukraine's control, hosting regular conferences on the war and the country's reconstruction efforts, as well as a high-profile Chinese delegation last year. The State Property Fund says there's already been interest, including from foreign operators. The sale is expected to take place later this year.
Isabella Jewell. Colombia has approved a ban on bullfighting, marking a significant victory for animal rights activists. Colombia is one of only 8 countries where bullfighting still takes place, the others being France, Portugal, Mexico, Ecuador, Peru, Spain and Venezuela. The BBC's Latin America online editor, Vanessa Buschluter, told Luke Jones why Colombia had decided to do this now.
For the last 10 years or so, there have been a lot of people who have been advocating for an end to bullfights. They say that it is incredibly cruel, and they have long fought for this on various platforms, trying to get the Constitutional Court to ban it and more recently to get Congress to ban it. And that's what's now happened. The Constitutional Court basically put the ball into the court of Congress and said, you have to legislate on this. So we've had a vote now, and the vast majority, 93 delegates out of 95, voted for a ban and only 2 against. But there's going to be a transition period of about 3 years, because that allows the government to give people who have been making a living from bullfight to find other sources of income. And this is why in the past attempts to have a ban passed through Congress failed, because there were many people who said, look, in my constituency, there's people who live from this, not just the people who breed bulls, who work on the farms that breed bulls, but also the street vendors. I mean, these are huge events where thousands of people cram into historic bull rings in major cities. And so you've got a whole industry built around this.
Yeah. And it's amazing that even with that 3-year transition period, there must still be people who will be out of pocket, annoyed by this. I mean, what do you even do with those historic bull rings that you mentioned?
Absolutely. Well, the historic bull rings, the idea is to turn them into venues that can host sporting events and concerts. So that is less of a problem. But what the aficionados of bullfighting are saying is that it's an art form. They don't even see it as a sport, but that is being lost. So they're seeing it as a threat to their way of life. And of course, many of the farmers who bred these beautiful fighting bulls say that if there's no need for them, that will also be lost.
Vanessa Buschluter, our Latin America online editor. It has been dubbed a Nigerian Game of Thrones. The northwestern city of Kano currently has 2 rival emirs sitting in separate palaces a few kilometres apart. The authorities have banned protests and rallies over fears that the royal spat could turn violent. Richard Hamilton is following the story.
Yes, it's a family power struggle over who should be the rightful heir. When the old emir, the previous one, died in 2014, he was not succeeded by his son, Aminu Ado Bayero, but the kingmakers decided his great-nephew, Muhammadu Sanusi, would take over. And this has been a source of contention, and it led to violent clashes at the time. And then 4 years ago, the governor of Kano deposed Mr. Sanusi and installed Mr. Bayero. And now the new governor has restored Mr. Sanusi to the throne. Meanwhile, Mr. Bayero has returned and declared himself the legitimate emir. On Tuesday, the Federal Court of Nigeria ordered that Mr. Sanusi should be evicted, but a state court went the other way and restrained the police from carrying it out.
Do emirs have much power in Nigeria?
No, they don't have much political power, but they have huge ceremonial traditional role. They're custodians of religion and culture. They're spiritual leaders. They have huge following and influence. The Emir of Kano is the second most senior Muslim leader in Nigeria after the Sultan of Sokoto. And this role goes back to pre-colonial times, before the creation of the modern state of Nigeria, when it was divided up into lots of different kingdoms. But because of their influence, politicians are keen to exploit their influence. So the governors and political parties have taken over, and it's really a power struggle for politics as well. So Mr. Sanusi is linked to the NNPP party, which controls the governorship, but Mr. Bayero is backed by President Tinubu's governing APC party. So this power struggle, which was a family struggle, is now a political one as well.
Richard Hamilton. Now, despite all the hype about it, a new survey suggests that very few people are actually using artificial intelligence products like ChatGPT. Researchers surveyed 12,000 people in six countries, including the UK, where only 2% of respondents said they employ such tools on a daily basis. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman has been looking at the research.
I'm probably not the typical AI customer to represent this particular study, but I think what is interesting about it is how, despite all of that money, all of that investment, all of that publicity, it feels like we've been talking so much about this particular kind of AI, generative AI. That's chatbots, you know, tools that make text, that create video, that create music. Lots of people have never even heard of them. 30% of the respondents in the UK hadn't heard of ChatGPT, which is absolutely the best known and most used chatbot. But they hadn't heard of its rivals either. They hadn't heard of Google's Gemini. They hadn't heard of Anthropic's Claude or any of the other tools that are out there on the market. And possibly there are two reasons for this. It tends to skew towards younger people in terms of who's interested in it. So the study found that 56% of 18 to 24s had at least had a go at it, whereas only 16% of over 55s had tried out this tool. And it does suggest, doesn't it, that in terms of embracing new tech, we're kind of where we've always been, where younger people are more interested and less afraid, maybe, of having a go. But also, it's not always been easy. You know, it's only been around ChatGPT for the last 18 months. Not all of these services are free. Some of them you have to sign up for. And all of that is friction, isn't it? It's a barrier to entry, if you like. Increasingly, we are seeing business uses being put for it, certainly in terms of writing reports, in terms of summarising meetings. Microsoft has invested billions of dollars in OpenAI, which is the creator of ChatGPT. And they now have a tool called Copilot that's embedded in Windows, which we know is used by millions of people who do office work. And that can help you with all sorts of office administrative type tasks. So we do know that that's the direction of travel. But actually, this study suggests that we're not there yet. Again, looking at the UK figures, 25% of the respondents said that they used some sort of chatbot for their personal lives, and only 20% had used them for their professional lives. That's not to say that people aren't very worried, though, that the better these tools become, the more of a threat they might become to people's jobs.
Our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman. It is nearly a year since the Titan submersible disappeared while travelling down to the wreck of the Titanic on the Atlantic sea floor. The craft imploded, killing all five people on board. Now another billionaire is reportedly preparing to make the same journey in a submersible built by a different company. According to the Wall Street Journal, Larry Connor, a billionaire from Ohio, and Patrick Leahy, founder and CEO of Triton Submarines, are planning to explore the Titanic wreck 3,800 metres down. They're planning to use a submersible called the Triton 4000, which costs $20 million and is said to be made with the latest materials and technology. So how different is this new submersible? Dr. Simon Boxall lectures in oceanography at the University of Southampton in southern England.
If you look at the terrible disaster of the Titan submersible, it was a poorly designed vessel. It didn't really go through full stringent safety checks. This new one, the Triton 4000, is a more traditional vessel. It is safer. But then the question is, why? You can't get out of a manned submersible. The pressure's too high. You're still restricted to using cameras, using lights, using your eyes, admittedly, but also using manipulators if you want to pick things up. And we do the same thing with an ROV. If something goes wrong with an ROV, it's embarrassing, you lose the equipment. If it goes wrong with a manned submersible, then you basically have fatalities. And of course, the problem we've got is that this is all happening in international waters. There are no, if you like, rules that govern some of the stuff that goes on. There's going to be a lot of eyes on this particular project. People are going to be asking questions of, have all the safety tests been done? And I suspect people going in it will be far more cautious But it is a form of tourism at the end of the day. It's very expensive tourism. We've seen it in space. We're seeing it in the deep ocean. I guess tourists have gone past the, I'm going to see the pyramids, I'm going to see the wonders of the world. They're now looking at the thrills of the world.
Oceanography expert Simon Boxall. Well, talking of thrills, it does pose the question, what kind of extreme experiences are people looking for? Liana Byrne asked Ricardo Araujo, who organises trips for clients who don't have to worry about the cost.
At the moment, we are currently building a super yacht trip, and in the middle, we are diving to explore an underwater city in Italy. So it's like about the Roman ruins, to see them up close, and then we are moving towards Egypt, where there are also ruins of the Cleopatra Palace. So those are like not as deep as the Titanic, of course, but that means you can also see them. So we have like some sunlight that's invisible.
That's a very lavish request. Is that one of the most unusual requests you've ever had to do?
Oh, not really. Let's say in my case, clients, yes, they come with requested, but after like 30 minutes, they realize it's better to give me like three brains to propose ideas, because as I always say, how can you request something you don't even know exists? Yes, for example, you know about the Titanic, but you might not know about the Shackleton to Antarctica, for example. North of Colombia, there is an amazing 16th century galleon who sank like in the 16th, 17th century, and they discovered it, and that one is full of gold. So going there with the scientific team who's undergoing the work to explore the wreck, that's way more incredible than just going somewhere to see something.
I'm just wondering, Ricardo, is there any ethical considerations in that? The fact that, you know, you are dealing with very wealthy people, but giving them access to things that not everybody would be able to get access to. Is there any ethical thoughts that might cross your mind about that?
A lot. First of all, we choose our clients. So if someone approached me tomorrow who's not the right client, I'm going to turn him away, no matter how much money he has or how much he's offering me. I had some people like putting money on the table to get me to work on their trips. But it's a no-go because that's not the right person. I look for people who have like a philanthropic soul, let's say, who likes those kind of adventures, who appreciate art, craftsmanship, who want to discover something. It's like trips to educate yourself. Imagine like a documentary where you are the hero.
Underwater expedition organizer Ricardo Araujo. And that is all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Chris Kouzaris and produced by Nikki Verrico. Our editor's Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.